accession number 4993, reel number 1.
Flight Lieutenant Reed, reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Flight Lieutenant Reed, when you first joined the RAF?
I joined the RAF in 1941. I was at school, actually, when the war started, and I finished my hires, to go to university in 1940, and then I wanted to join the RAF because my brother was in Blenheims at the time, and he went missing in 1940. So my mother felt that, I should hold on a bit. So I did wait, and then I tried one or two jobs, which were student training in metallurgy. And then, funnily enough, I got frightened that I might be reserved because metallurgy and steel and whatnot was a reserved occupation, but I was purely a student. And I then joined the RAF, but I was put in about 9 months deferred service, during which time I became a postman, at Christmas time, and odd jobs and different. In fact, one of them was actually helping to remove stone dikes, stone walls from a near field in pasture, ready for an extension to Schoon Airfield. And I was actually called into the Air Force in August 1941. My service started.
And what category did you go into?
I joined up as a pilot, yes, as an aircrew. And I happened to pass to get into the pilot training side. I then went to ACRC in London, and then from there to Cornwall for ITW, and then we were fortunate enough to go abroad to train. I trained in California in America at a BFTS, number 2 BFTS. And that was the first time I flew. I hadn't flown until I got there. And we were probably one of the first to go abroad with uniform, because before that, they still wore civilian clothes. Because America still wasn't in the war. And we trained in California to get my wings in June 1942. But meantime, of course, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and America joined the war in December 41. And I then came back, and of course, having trained in single engines, which I did 200 hours in singles, I trained in wings on Harvard 2As. That's the same as the same as I would in this country, in fact. I then felt I would like to actually go on more than single engine. Of course, when everybody joined initially, or during the war, there was this glamour of being a fighter pilot. But I felt I would like to go on, maybe it was my Scottish instinct, to get more training onto double or single, more than single engines. So I offered myself for Bomber Command, and I was then sent to, although offering in some ways meant nothing. If they needed fighter pilots, they would have sent you to fighter pilots. The business of brown eyes for fighters and blue eyes for bombers, or the other way around, was a sort of thing that went about. But if they needed pilots for bombers, they sent you there, and that was it. And it happened, I think, at that time they needed bomber pilots. And this was about July of 42. I then went to train on Oxford's as twin engines, and then from twin engines I went on to Wellington's, to an OTU in Rutland, and finishing my OTU with then the makings of a crew. That's when you pick up operational training unit at North Luffenham. I had then a navigator, a wireless operator, and front gunner, or rear gunner, sorry. So that was, you started your makings of a crew, and you would then normally go on to a conversion unit to whatever plane you were going to use to fly in your operations. But when we finished our OTU training, the wing commander flying asked me if I would stay on to be what they called a screen crew. In other words, train other crews or sit beside them and watch what they were doing, like an instructor. And my crew and myself didn't feel this was the right thing to do, because we had just been training ourselves. And we felt we wanted to go on to ops and do our tour and then come back and train, which most folk did. So we had to talk about this, and I went back and said to him, no, would rather, go and do a tour and whatnot. So he then said, well, I can tell you this, I can guarantee your Lancaster posting if you do stay and do this 3 months. And at that time, there were still quite a number of Halifax and Stirling postings, and we knew the Lancaster was the best of plane. So that managed to persuade my crew to stay and do a bit of training. But instead of being 3 months, it lasted for about 6 months, during which time I flew about 300 hours in on Wellingtons, training other crews. And in lots of ways, I think this was a help, because I got a lot more flying training than I'd had, than I would have had if I'd gone straight onto ops. So from there, we then eventually went on to a conversion unit at Wigsley. And I had the misfortune again, of course, even at my operational training unit, my navigator was a French-Canadian called Burgoyne, and he kept being sick when he was flying. And I think once he brought up blood, so they scrubbed him off, and he was a good navigator. So they scrubbed him, so I lost my initial navigator, and I had to take this, who was another Canadian, a chap called Anderson. So I then remade our crew, and we went on to a conversion unit at Wigsley to fly Lancasters, to convert onto Lancasters. And we converted onto Lancasters, and of course there you naturally pick up an engineer then, flight engineer, and a mid-upper gunner, which you haven't had before. You've all just had a rear gunner. So you picked up two new buds then. And then when you finish your training, it's usual that that you go on an operation as a second dickie. That means with another crew, so you see what's happening. And I went with one crew from 619 Squadron, and my navigator went with another crew from another squadron. And my navigator's plane was lost that night, so I lost my navigator again before we'd even started NOBS. So that, and what usually happens in those cases is that they start robbing your crew. Other crews who have lost their gunner or something else start saying, well, I'll take his gunner now, so while you're waiting for a navigator. So while I was waiting to pick up another navigator, my gunners went. So then I had to get a navigator and two gunners, which I then picked up, and my flight engineer, and eventually we were then posted to 61 Squadron at Saracen. And it was while I was flying of 61 Squadron at Saracen that I got my VC. You know, that was my 10th trip.
How did that happen?
Well, that was a trip to Dusseldorf, and what actually happened was that I had was attacked just after attack, I crossed the Dutch coast. We're flying about 21,000 feet, and when we were attacked, it was such a burst in my face. I was sure it was flak, that, you know, I predicted a hack that had hit us, because I'd had no warnings at all from a gunner. And normally they would say dive starboard, dive port, but his hands were nearly frozen because his heating system wasn't working properly and he hadn't time to switch on his microphone. But I lost about 2,000 feet, and then they said, no, it was an ME-110 that attacked us. So I circled and I could talk to him, and I was wounded, but there wasn't much point in saying, I didn't feel as if I had dropped dead. I didn't see much point in panicking and saying I'm wounded and whatnot, so, and I felt fit enough to drive on. And we flew on, we sorted our courses out again, and we were again attacked about a quarter an hour later. And this time everything went dead, the intercom went dead, and we had no oxygen because that was blown off. And the compasses were broken. The windscreen was completely shattered. And my engineer was wounded in the forearm, which I didn't know at the time, but I could see him holding both hands together. And our rear elevator, the port elevator, had been blown away on the tailplane, so that we had to hold the stick back in our belly to keep it straight and level. You know how it works. So it was quite a job to hold this and full. I think it was full left rudder we had to hold to and hold the stick back to keep it going straight now. And we're down to about 17,000 feet by this time. I'd lost more feet, another 2,000 feet. So I flew on, and then I pointed to the compass because we couldn't talk to each other. It was too noisy. You couldn't hear. And pointed back to the cabin where the navigator was, meaning get me another course. And he come back and shook his hand, lying down as if he'd been knocked out. So I then looked for the pole star and the moon, because you know the courses you fly. When you're at briefing, you know you do 110 or 130 or whatever it is. And this particular night we were bombing Düsseldorf, but we were heading straight for Cologne in the last leg, and they were dropping spoof flares on Cologne as if we were going to bomb Cologne. But in the last 20 minutes we turned onto 060 and went up and bombed Düsseldorf. And I felt that well, if I was going to overshoot the target, because it's all, you know, within minutes of timing this, when you're talking about the flares going down and when the actual target, the bombs are going to be dropped. I thought, if I'm going to overshoot, I'll see these is happening and I can see what's happening. And sure enough, we could see the flares going down in Cologne, so I turned up at 06 with the bomb in Düsseldorf. And you could see other planes off beside you, which you often did at night. Even, you know, you could see another plane out beside you, flying more or less in the same direction. And we headed, I put down my handle for the bombs dropping, because the opening the bomb doors, although the bomb doors, the hydraulics had gone, I had still to make the connection, put my handle down, and they opened, but they wouldn't shut again. And I had just to keep it straight and level as far as I could see with the target indicators for the bombing, but to drop the bomb, because we couldn't talk to each other. And I pointed ahead at this, and I just kept it straight and level on this. And then I felt the bombs going off and held it till the picture was taken, which was about half a minute later. Then we started to fly home. And meantime, of course, the navigator, the engineer had been giving me oxygen bottles, because you carry these portable oxygen bottles in different places in case you move the plane above 10,000. And having no oxygen, he fed these to me every 20 minutes or half an hour or so. And then I turned back to head for home, and we oscillated a bit then, and I suppose I passed out occasionally, but I came to again, and the navigator and the bomber, I mean, and the engineer kept holding the stick with me, you know, to keep it straight now. And we did go over a lot of undefended, you know, areas we should never have flown over and got flak at us, but we didn't get hit again. And eventually we got over what I thought was the North Sea, because I could see the mass of the sea anyway. And we come down quicker then to get below this oxygen height, so we were at least more sensible. And when we're over the North Sea, the whole four engines cut. And this has never been reported in our citation or this, but it actually happened. And this was pure and simply a case. You normally, the engineer tried to keep the petrol and the petrol tanks fairly even, so if you get a petrol tank hit, you wouldn't lose half your petrol, all your petrol. So you kept them fairly even right up to the target, and then you kept them back and forward, use it partly, and then use the other one partly. So he had forgotten to switch over the petrol tank since when the action had started, and would just run out of petrol. And of course the engine, the plane just settled, the Lancaster just had to settle. And there had no vices in the Lancaster, you know, it just settled a broody hen, you know, just settled down, none of this spinning in there. And then I remember when they turned on the petrol tank, of course with the props windmilling, it started up again. So we started up and headed again for the English shore. And then saw some pundits flashing, beacons flashing. So I again pointed back and get the wireless operator's flimsy, because he's got a secret flimsy that gives you all the beacons that flash in the area you're going to cover. So you can read this off and say it's Helmswell or Tangmere or whatever it is, you know. And it was a small training drone, this YF or whatever it was that we'd read off this. And so it was no good, so we just kept heading on. And then we saw in front of us this great big canopy of searchlights. And often this meant, you know, over a drone, sort of lead you on and bring you back with searchlights. They were lame ducks, they used to call this. If they saw somebody that was in trouble, they might lead them on and knew it was a British plane and sweep you towards where you should go, and you would follow this searchlight. But we could see this big canopy of searchlights, so I walked towards that. But on the way towards it, I came on this great big DREM system lit up below us, and I could see by the type of lighting that it was a big runway, you know, the DREM system and a funnel approach. So I circled that. Of course, having no intercom, we couldn't call up. So I flashed my landing lamp for landing. And then, of course, having no hydraulics, I had to use my air bottle to put down the undercarriage and the flaps. And you have to pump it down. And when I pumped it, my head started to bleed again because it was cut up here and sort of ran in my eyes. My shoulder was still sore. But they were still holding back the stick together with me. And we flew around this, and I saw the gooseneck flare, the sodium flares lit up. And we come down and made a long approach and landed. And as we landed, the lower leg, the legs collapsed and went along their belly for about 50 yards. And it was only then, when I switched off everything, that I saw Jeff, my navigator, had slid up beside me then. He'd lying dead back in his cabin and slid forward. And it was American drum shipped them in Norfolk that we'd landed at. And we all got through the escape hatch above the dinghy escape hatch and out onto the wing and into this ambulance. And my wireless operator came out with us. But he died 2 days later. They looked at Jeff when we went in, both of us took us into the medical side and looked at us, and he was obviously dead, and they put him aside and started cleaning up my shoulder and my head wound and whatnot. And I had a blood transfusion. And we were there that night, and then they took us to Norwich Cottage Hospital the next day, and I had some more treatment to my shoulder. And 3 days later, as I say, well, 2 days later, the wireless op died, and then they moved us down, my engineer and I, down to Ely Hospital for treatment at King Cambridge, RAF Hospital, Ely.
How long was it before you were flying again?
Well, that happened on the 3rd of November, 43, and I was flying again in January, 44.
Were you on the same type of work?
No, when I came back from sick leave, I was posted then to 617 Squadron, which is the dam busting squadron. But that was after the dam busting, you know, in 44. And I then had to make a crew up again. And I took with me the bomb aimer was the only one of my original crew that came with me. And then I made up another crew with this chap, Luca, that I knew in OTU. He'd done a tour before when I was training. And I had another French-Canadian navigator this time, Orville Peltier. And then the gunners, Hutton, Warrant Officer Hutton, and then Holt, so it hasn't Holt. They'd both done tours, so I picked them up as well. And my wireless operator was, as I said, was Luca. My flight engineer was a chap called Stewart, Chunky Stewart. So there was only Ralton from the original crew that came on with me then. Then we flew with 617 from then up till 31st of July. And the 31st of July, we were on a daylight trip. And bombing these V2 bomb storages east of Paris, those sort of tunnels that we were, 617 were actually a place called Juvisy. We were dropping 12,000 pound bombs on the end of the tunnel to try and close it, and 9 Squadron were bombing the northern end to try and close it, and the rest of the squadron were dropping single 1,000 pounds or semi delayed action to keep them from salvaging them. And it was a daylight. It was bombed about 7:30 in fact at night. It was a sunlight, not a sunny day. And just after we dropped our bomb, because it took a long time for us to run up, we had about a 4 minute run up to drop this one bomb, you know, to make sure we dropped it in the right place. My engineer, my bomb aimer shouted, hold it, because I had turned straight off, because they said if there's any flak, don't bother taking pictures, which means you have to stay straight and level for another 20, 30 seconds. So whenever I dropped the bomb, I started to turn off, and he said, hold it. And I thought, yeah, it's a bloody picture, you see, so I brought it back again. And just after I brought it back, I felt this clump, and bombs come down through us from the plane above, you know, a stick of bombs straddled us. Of course, they just go through you, they don't go off and off, and I said, stand by to bail out, because there's no control in the stick. And I think the port outer engine fell away. And then we started to turn in. And, of course, they were giving me my parachute, passing me to try and go and get down into the bomb aimer's escape hatch, you know, because he just lifts the hatch and drops out. And I got my parachute on. It was a breast pack. And I couldn't really get it on, I felt, properly, you know, because all your harness and stuff's about your face. So I did eventually get it on. But I'd say this was taking seconds to act. And the plane was starting to spin down. And my wireless operator had been the last one up into the nose, because the others, as soon as Chunky Stewart had given me my parachute, he followed the others into the nose to get out of the bomber's hole. You know, he just lifts off the hatch and drops through. And the gunners, of course, have got to get out as best they can when it's an emergency like that. Just get out as soon as they can. And I couldn't get out of my seat, so I was trying to open the side window to slip out that. I couldn't open them because of this pressure on it. And then I thought this dinghy escape hatch, so I started to turn the handle above me again, this escape hatch onto the roof. And I think the whole nose must have come off, because the next thing I knew was quiet and I was falling through the air. And I felt for my parachute cord and I pulled it. And then I hung onto the shrouds because I thought I'd put it on so fast that it might fly away from me. I wasn't too sure that it was going to stay on me. And I hung onto these shrouds. And then my other worry then was in case bits of the plane were going to come down through me because it had been broken up. And then, of course, I had to watch what was happening in the ground. I saw these trees coming up and watched that. I kept my legs together when I went into these trees and landed right into the top of a tree. I don't know whether I hit my leg then or whether it was the plane coming out, and it felt as if it was broken on my left leg. But it was just numb, you know, just whether it would hit this tree or not. And my right hand was broken and bleeding a bit here. My face was all scratched with bits of the plane, you know, having scrape coming out. My ear cut with the aerial and things like this. But it just hardened up, hardened blood in no time at all. So I slid down the tree and I took my May West off because, as I say, it was a daylight raid in this big yellow May West. And I stuffed it under the bushes. And then I started to head because I could hear the bombs going off in the target. Still, we're quite close to the target then. Still delayed action going off. And I headed about half a mile down this forest and sat down behind this clump of wood and got my shell dressing out, which we always carried inside our battle dressing, wrapped up my hand. And got up, and I thought, I'll look and see my escape kit and get north, south, east, and west, and I could speak enough French to get past. And I thought, I'll head south and then go to Paris. And as I stood up, these three Germans come up with their rifles and bayonet, you know, Halten sie auf and Hands hoch and whatnot, and that was me taken prisoner. And they then took me back to their ACAC site, which was in the field. And on the way back, we passed the tail part of my plane. I could see it was my plane. And I pointed to it to see if I can go and see it. So I went to see it, and the mid-upper gunner was still inside the tail part. Because he has to get out of his turret, get down and get his chute, and then make his way back to the back door. No, man, he has no hope in hell if it's spinning in. And the rear turret was about 50 yards away with the rear gunner still in it with his chute streamed. So he had managed to get his chute and put it on, and they had to turn the turret so they could lean into the plane, get the parachute, put it on, and then turn the turret, and then bail out backwards. So to do that again in an emergency was, you know, very remote. In fact, we used to say nearly every briefing we had, that why don't they make some sort of parachute that was a clothing type that they actually wore like a flying suit, that they just bailed out and then pulled something and it all worked. Because it was impossible for them to get it in a real emergency to get their shooting time. So I told her, I didn't see any point in not telling them their names, so I told this German the names of these two, what Officer Hutton and Holt. And then went back to this flak site, and the doctor looked at me and had something stuck in my side too, and he just put some iodine paste and he left her blood undercut and said, just keep wetting my hand and keep the bandage tight. And half an hour later, two Germans come up with my wireless operator, Luca, hobbling between them with a big swollen ankle. So when I talked to him, he said that all he remembered was being thrown forward into the front of the cockpit and feeling something there. And then the next thing, he felt himself falling through the air. And the next thing, he felt himself lying on the ground with these Germans standing over him. So what had happened probably was his chute had been pulled in the plane. And I don't know yet what happened to the others, whether the plane trapped them in and they couldn't get out, you know, the nose, and they'd been trapped in the nose all the way down or something. But he'd obviously fallen free. And his chute, pardon me, had been streamed because it had maybe been torn. And when he hit the ground, knocked him out. This is why his ankle was so big. So, but we still didn't know what had happened to the other members of the crew, other than the two gunners. And through interrogation, they were always said, of course, all your crew are dead, they would say to each of us. And well, we knew he was my crew member, and I knew I was his member. So when we thought the other, the navigator, the bombing, and the engineer were away, and particularly the navigator being a French-Canadian could speak fluent French, I thought, they've gone. But it wasn't until we came back to England we found out they'd actually been killed in the actual, and were shot down.
So, what happened to you next? Were you interrogated?
You know, they kept us there just till they could move us to this. It was a sort of like an army barracks place with just a room for the night and stand guard over us and gave us some coffee. And then they took us to Reims, and we sat there, and the guards, barracks, little rooms, just really on this main street, till we were to be taken in to be interrogated by somebody in Reims. And they took us across, remember, it was a big house there, and he asked us, and we just said name, rank and number. Well, we're taken individually. And I just kept saying this, and he just took us back, had coffee again then. And then we moved from there up to a place, I think it was called Juvincourt. A village, this was a farmhouse that they had taken over, and they used this a front room with iron bars, and it was a sort of temporary prison. Upstairs, you know, like the room at the top of the stairs. And there were these two persons, or two guards, that looked after us on rotation. And then they just took us down the back. There was a latrine right up at the back of the farm, the yard, at the back of the farm, because you know these typical French villages with a farm facing onto the street. Well, right at the back of their steading are the buildings. There was a latrine, and we took her down to that when we needed to, you know, once at night or twice a day or something. And we were there for about 3 days. And then they took us to Brussels. At that farmhouse, we just stayed there. Nobody talked to us other than the old guards and that. And then when we were taken to Brussels, we were then interrogated again. And we were in single cells then, little cells with in a big building. They were made up cells, just like single cells with a sort of mesh in the roof, you know, mesh inside this big building.
Was the interrogation more thorough than the interrogation before?
Well, again, he started to say again, what squadron were you with? And we know you're with your crew are all dead and whatnot. You might as well tell us. And I just kept saying name, rank, and number and whatnot, and that was it.
Did they seem to know a lot about your...
Well, they talked about... once or twice they mentioned the squadron. You've been with the 617 squadron, but I just sat his hand, didn't make any acknowledgement. But they didn't go into great details. Really, the way we had been hearing this before we were ever shot down, you know how you used to get instructed in what you might be asked, and don't answer anything, otherwise they might pick up from it and never confirm even what they have. So if you just keep repeating a name, rank and number, and then apologize for doing it every so often, which I did, it gets a bit monotonous, and I just kept doing this, and well, they're probably nearly a week, maybe 5 days. Well, it might have been less, because I then went to Wetzlar, where they interrogated you then, at Frankfurt. They took us in a lorry just in between the drivers, sitting one on each lorry, to save their transport, I suppose. And we went to Wetzlar at Frankfurt, and that was the real interrogation centre. And that's when they started to sit and try and talk to you and bring up more about squadrons and how the war was going and whatnot. And my main worry by that time was getting a bath, because I hadn't had, you know, I'd never had a real bath, and our clothes were getting stinky, because we'd still been in the same clothes for the week or 10 days. And I remember going in, they looked a reasonable looking chap that was at Wetzlar and interviewed him, and he asked you, did you have you anything? I said, I'd like to have a shave and a bath, change my clothes. Well, I'll see to that, and away we put you into this there were swords of confinement again, just a little tiny cell with a bed in it. And nothing happened, you just got your soup pushed into you, a bit of bread. So it was another day and a half before I saw him, and then when he saw me again, I said, what about my bath, you know, my shower? He says, oh, I'm sorry. And so then I went and had a shower. That would be about probably 10 days after I had been shot down, before I had my real good wash, you know, a real good shower. And I just stood and washed my underwear and everything, and then I rinsed them out afterwards. That was, I think, one of the most miserable things about it. And then there wasn't a lot of food going. And I think there, there did seem one or two people moving about, actually freeish looking there. I remember asking one, when I got the razor to shave with, of course I had to give them all back again, the razor blade and everything. And I remember seeing a chap with a book, And I said, where did you get the book? Because a book, sitting reading a book would have been ideal in the solitary. So I did have a chance to look over this window and see some, looked obviously at farm workers and that working in fields. I just sat, watched for a time and then just lay in your bed and thought about other things. It was very, very hot, beginning of August. And